Okay, and here we go, our number three. Interesting title for a book, if nothing else, but there's a lot more else. Weird Secrets Inside the Canyon. Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream, written by David McGowan, who was down there. It's quite a fascinating book. It's a look at a little niche in Hollywood land, greater Hollywood land, that begat an awful lot of the icons and stars and celebrities and trendsetters of the 60s, 70s, 80s. Think about this. Laurel Canyon in the 1960s and early 70s was a magical place where a dizzying array of musical artists congregated to create much of the music that provided the soundtrack to those very turbulent times. Members of bands like The Byrds, The Doors, Buffalo Springfield, The Monkees, The Beach Boys, The Turtles, The Eagles, The Flying Burrito Brothers, Frank Zappa, and The Mothers of Invention, of course, Steppenwolf, CSN, Three Dog Night, and Love, along with such singer-songwriters as Joni Mitchell, Judy Collins, James Taylor, and Carole King, lived together and jammed together in the bucolic community nestled in the Hollywood Hills. But there was a dark side to that scene as well, and that's captured in Dave McGowan's new book. Many didn't make it out of there alive. We never hear about those, of course. And many deaths remain shrouded in mystery to this very day. Far more integrated into the scene than most would like to admit was a guy by the name of Charles Manson, along with his murderous entourage. Also floating about the periphery were various political operatives, up-and-coming politicians, and intelligence personnel, the same sort of people who gave birth to many of the rock stars populating the canyon. And all the canyon's colorful characters, rock stars, hippies, murderers, and politicians, politicos to be more exact, happily coexisted alongside a covert military installation. That's quite a book description. Hello, Dave. Can you hear me all right?
I can indeed. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Were you there? Were you in it?
I was not in it. I was unfortunately born a little too late. I was born in 1960, so my teen years, my formative years, were in the late 70s. So I was about a decade too late.
What got you interested in this? Where'd you hear about it?
It was kind of a fluke, really. But by the way, you did a fantastic job on that. Are you available for recording audiobooks?
I would always, I would like to do some audiobooks, actually. It'd be fun.
What got me, it was really a fluke, actually. About 7 years ago, I was going on vacation with my then wife, and we were heading off to, I believe, to Hawaii. And
you can't remember if you were still married to her, you'd be in big
service.
Trouble.
Uh-oh. Please try again.
I don't know what that meant.
We're sorry. The extension you dialed is not in service. Please.
Ooh. It sounds like somebody doesn't want us to talk. Let's see what happens when Todd tries to call him back. If all else fails, I'll read from the book. That's very interesting. I've never heard the extension you tried to call this in. Very odd. Very odd. That's an odd one. Maybe some of you work for the phone companies and have heard that. Are you there, Dave? Not yet. All right. Well, we're trying. We're trying. Okay. There he is. He's back.
I'm back.
You ever heard a recording like that come on in the middle of nothing? Not that you weren't saying anything, but
I got like a ring, like some like a call was coming through or something. But it wasn't the normal kind of ring that I normally get on my phone. So I wasn't sure what was going on.
Well, that was the NSA.
And then it just died. But anyways, I started to say I was, as I explain it in the preface to the book, it began very innocently when I was going on vacation, and my goal was really to kind of try to escape from from all of this, the insanity that, you know, I normally spend my time researching and writing about. And my daughter had gotten me a book by Michael Walker called Laurel Canyon that, you know, tells a very mainstream version of the story. And it just seemed like that would be sort of the perfect, you know, last speech, you know, turning off your mind kind of a book that I could just, you know, relive all this great music that had sort of provided the soundtrack to my youth and escape from all the madness that I usually spend my time delving into. And instead, as I read through this book, there was all these little red flags that kept coming up, you know, and kind of ended up ruining my vacation, really, because I just got so absorbed in the story and all the little kind of throwaway details that he just kind of tossed off to the side as you know, sort of interesting but, you know, insignificant little details. And to me, you know, the more I read into it, the more I realized that there was a whole other story, you know, hidden in those details. And so as soon as I got back from that vacation, I just dove headlong into the subject and just started getting every book and gathering every book and magazine article and web post and everything I could find, you know, that had ever been written about that scene, and putting all the little pieces together that didn't quite fit in with the peace, love, and understanding, you know, picture that we're supposed to have of the scene. And,
right.
You know, eventually realized that there was a whole nother side to that scene and a whole nother story that needed to be told. So, it just grew out of that, just a fluke, really. I mean, I grew up alongside of it, you know. I grew up in Torrance, like 20 miles south of the mouth of Laurel Canyon, and, you know, throughout my adult life, I've driven through it hundreds of times, getting across the city and, you know, just used it as another thoroughfare through the city and never knew that it had any special significance at all, you know. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about it is that so few people even know the mainstream story of Laurel Canyon. Even native, you know, Angelenos, people that grew up here, are largely unaware that this whole scene ever even happened. So, yeah, even though I grew up alongside of it, you know, I really knew nothing about it until like 7-8 years ago. And everything that I know, everything that went into the book, is all stuff that I've learned since then. So.
Can you tell me which came first, the music and the hippies and then the government, or the government and then the music and the hippies?
I believe it's the latter. You know, there's long been debate about the 60s counterculture and you know, whether it was at some point, you know, co-opted, so to speak, and misdirected by the government. But, you know, based on all the research that I've done, I would conclude that it was never legitimate, you know, from the start, that it was created, you know, as a, you know, psyop, so to speak. From the beginning, and that everything that grew out of it was, you know, I don't think it was ever the organic, you know, grassroots sort of thing that we're supposed
to
believe it is.
This, of course, dovetails into Tavistock, and the concept of Tavistock had a lot to do with pop culture, pop music, created it, manufactured it, disseminated it, and it took off from there. Now, in the canyon, in Laurel Canyon, where was this military? I guess it was an obvious military facility of some kind. Was it in the canyon or just nearby?
No, it was actually right in the canyon. It was on Wonderland Pass Avenue, I think it was what it was. You're pretty much right in the heart of the canyon.
There's a psychedelic name for you.
What's that?
There's a psychedelic name for you, Wonderland Path.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Wonderland Avenue is one of the main routes through there, and of course where the infamous Wonderland murders occurred. And Lookout Mountain Laboratory was right smack dab in the center of the canyon, actually, and it was initially built, according to most reports, as a covert air defense facility. Like during World War II, an
old Ajax missile site or something?
Something along those lines, mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the fortifications they have up in San Francisco mm-hmm. that were mm-hmm. built in that same era. And then it morphed into a covert film studio where they processed all the film stock from the atomic weapons test and...
Right there in Coldwater Canyon, Laurel Canyon? They processed the film right there in Laurel Canyon?
Yeah.
Oh, they had a lot of other facilities. I wonder why they... That's interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, it was actually said to be the world's only complete self-contained film studio. I mean, they could do everything from soup to nuts, so to speak. They had film vaults, they had sound stages, they had special effects departments.
Yeah.
They had everything they needed to do a complete film in-house from beginning to end. The only studio in the world that at the time that had that that capacity. And according to various reports, a lot of the technology, that we see today was first developed there. They had it before anyone else, like, 3D technology and various other things.
So you're talking about... early black ops stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, technically it was primarily used for, they processed all of the atomic weapons test footage there. In fact, some of it, there's actually film stock that has their logo stamped on it, Lookout Mountain Laboratory. But they also did propaganda film, and they employed some of Hollywood's biggest stars. People like John Wayne and Marilyn Monroe, and big name film directors like Howard Hawks and John Ford, and various other people, big names like Jimmy Stewart, who did work for the facility on a classified nature. And none of them ever talked about it, during their lifetime. So, we don't really know what exactly it was that they did. But they, at times, there were Hollywood luminaries who reported to duty there doing something. So, it's a very interesting facility, to say the least. And the fact that it just so happened to be located literally right in the heart of where the whole 60s counterculture thing, was kind of given birth, right around this facility. So, very odd, to say the least.
Question. Some of the people I named in the introduction, do you think they may have been trained intel assets with musical talent, or were there... There had to be a genesis for all of this talent, and I'm wondering if it was grassroots, or if it was somehow computer projected to be cool. They knew where the masses could be taken, and they turned these people loose in this group and encouraged others to move there. Whatever, they tend to magnetize each other and move in together. But where did the talent come from? Was it contrived or was it real?
Some of these people definitely had talent.
There's no question about that. Right. But did they get...
It's undeniable. Some of the songs, the music that was created then is, you can still turn on any number of classic rock stations on the radio today and, hear these songs played as daily staples, mm-hmm. These artists... there was, phenomenal music, and there was definitely a considerable amount of talent there. But the question is, why were so many of them, was it a huge preponderance of them, you know, from direct comes directly from military and military intelligence families. You know, it's just it's far more so than could be accounted for by, you know, just coincidence or by the fact that a lot of people have suggested that that these people were rebelling against, you know, the values of their parents and whatnot, and that may be true in some cases, but just the sheer number of them who can be traced directly to the military intelligence establishment would seem to suggest that there was something more at play here than just talent.
Well, would they, you know, would they necessarily know that they were being messed with, seeded, so to speak, to go in amongst this group? No, they wouldn't.
I think a lot of them were probably groomed from, you know, so to speak, from a pretty early age, you know, and some of these, some of them came from very, very wealthy and powerful families that went back, that go back, you know, 200 plus years in American history, and, you know, the families that have wielded vast amounts of, you know, financial and political power in this country, you know, for a very long time. You know, David Crosby is from a very distinguished family line, and, you know, guys like Ned Doheny was from the ridiculously wealthy, you know, Doheny oil clan, and guys like Graham Parsons, whose family owned just had vast citrus holdings in Florida and Georgia, you know, just, I mean, so these were people that grew up in a very entitled sort of atmosphere.
Well, you're
saying
that some of them may have
been. I think they probably just kind of assumed that they would, you know, that they were entitled to take, you know, kind of these leadership positions, you know.
Right. So there were some blue bloods in there somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, quite a few actually. They tended to come from either very wealthy families or military intelligence families or both, you know, at times. To a very strong degree. I mean, just to an amazing degree. You know, like Jim Morrison's dad was the Navy Admiral who, you know, was directly overseeing the Tonkin Gulf incident. Frank Zappa's dad was a chemical warfare engineer. All three guys from America were sons of Air Force officers. They mm-hmm. first met on an Air Force base in the UK. Jackson Brown was born on a military base in occupied Germany post-World War II. You know, Emmylou Harris grew up on a series of military bases in and around Washington, D.C., you know, just John Phillips' dad mm-hmm. was a career Marine Corps officer, and his mother, sister, and first wife were all career employees of the Defense Department, Pentagon employees. And, I mean, just on and on through the list, just to an astonishing degree, it's very difficult to find somebody who emerged as a major star from that scene who wasn't, you know, connected either to the military intelligence establishment or to a, you know, blue blood, you know, sort of royal bloodline.
Okay. All right. Now, the dissemination of the product that came out of Laurel Canyon was pretty easy. Music industry's right there. You get a playlist on a station and enough drugs and almost anything sounds good, I guess, after a while. It wasn't hard to lead the pack.
What's that?
It wasn't hard to lead the pack. Enough drugs and almost anything sounds good after a while.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the reality is that, you know, the music that we know and love so well from these bands, you know, a lot of people don't like to hear it, but the reality is that a lot of it wasn't actually played by the guys on the album covers, you know, like the Mamas and the Papas, the Beach Boys, the Early Birds, you know, quite a few of these bands, the Turtles, and, you know, most of them, actually. In the beginning, at least, the recorded versions of their songs were done by studio musicians. And, you know, I have all kinds of quotes from people who were on the scene, including, like, the band's own, like, producers and managers, of, like, the Doors and the Birds and whatnot, saying, you know, they weren't all that good live, you know? The kids gave them a pass because, you know, there was a lot of other distractions going on, and you know, everybody was high, so they give them a pass on the live shows. But the recorded music was a whole different thing. And, you know, a lot of these bands, just at the beginning at least, they did not really have the musical chops to record their own music. And so it was done by studio musicians. So, you know, I mean, a lot of these bands had a really contrived sort of quality about them, particularly the Byrds, who were really the first ones out of the chute, the band that really set off the whole folk rock revolution.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was two of the guys were basically cast because they had the right look. You know, the bass player and the drummer had never played bass or drums before, you know. And you had Crosby and Gene Clark, who could kind of play passable guitar, but, you know, weren't anything special. And the only real musician in the group was Jim McGuinn, who was a very good guitarist. And
but your point is really important, and that's when they went in the studio, all kinds of things could be done to the music. Hey, do you have any? We got to take a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you, any reason to think that some of the music might have been augmented in the studio with subliminal sounds, EMF, some kinds of frequency noise, vibrational stuff that would have done more than just create a pleasant sound for people? We'll talk about that in a minute. Talking with Dave McGowan and his very interesting book, Weird Secrets Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. Okay, back with Dave McGowan. Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. Dark Heart. A lot of people went in. Not all of them came out. Murders. Drug overdoses. Tell me more. What happened?
Yeah, there was a astounding number. There was just a huge body trail leading out of Laurel Canyon.
How huge? You know, what are you talking, dozens?
Yeah, easily. You know, including the two most notorious mass murders in the city's history, which would be the Manson murders and the Wonderland murders. Both involving five victims, all five died in the Cielo Drive house, and four of the five died at the Wonderland house, and both of those were directly connected to Laurel Canyon. The Wonderland killings actually occurred right in Laurel Canyon on Wonderland Boulevard, and the Manson, there were a couple canyons over in Benedict Canyon, but all of the people involved, both victims and perpetrators, were all part of the Laurel Canyon scene. Charlie and his entourage were part of the scene, as were Frytowski and Folger were actually living in Laurel Canyon at the time, in a house right across the road from Mama Cass. And Jay Sebring was the guy credited with creating Jim Morrison's famous hairstyle, and was a business partner of John Phillips. And Michelle Phillips was also very good friends with both John Phillips and Cass Elliott. So all of these people spent a lot of time in Laurel Canyon and had mutual friends and traveled in the same social circles. So, the Manson and the Wonderland were directly connected to Laurel Canyon. And in addition, there were just a staggering number of other deaths, curious deaths. Some of them quite famous people. Ramon Navarro, famous film star, was murdered in Laurel Canyon.
Yeah.
What's that?
That goes way back, yeah.
Yeah, he was murdered in his Laurel Canyon home on the eve of Halloween, 1969, right at the peak of the Laurel Canyon scene. He was ritually murdered in his home.
Well, he was he was a silent film star, was he not? Ramon Navarro.
He was a contemporary of Valentino. He was a Latin lover, kind of a lesser known. He probably got all the roles that Valentino passed on, or something. You know.
And that's where you mentioned Inger Stevens died.
Yeah, Inger Stevens. She also died in her Laurel Canyon home, right in that same era. Her death was ruled either a suicide or an accident or something, but it didn't really look much like a suicide or an accident. And then Sal Mineo was murdered in the driveway of his home right at the mouth of Laurel Canyon. Diane Winkletter supposedly jumped off the balcony of her apartment, also right at the mouth of Laurel Canyon. Lenny Bruce found dead in his home, just not too far, kind of in between Laurel and Coldwater Canyon. And just a whole bunch of other people. You know, Graham Parsons, very curious death. Clarence White of the Byrds. It's a staggering list. There's like two chapters in the book, actually, that are just specifically dedicated to listing all of the curious and violent deaths that were associated with what was supposed to be a scene that was all about peace, love, and understanding.
Well, Superman died there too.
Did he?
Laurel
Possible.
Canyon. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was in Laurel Canyon. 1959.
It's unbelievable how many, you know, Brandon DeWilde, who was a young actor who was part of the scene, and various wives and girlfriends. Jackson Brown's wife turned up dead. I think hers was ruled a suicide. David Crosby's girlfriend died. I think that one was ruled to be a car accident. Graham Nash's girlfriend, Amy Gossage, died. Hers was actually acknowledged as a murder that was pinned on her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's just mind-boggling how many people who either died in the canyon or people who were a major part of that scene who died elsewhere under you know, very oftentimes very, very suspicious circumstances. Just a mind-boggling.
There were
actually like three girls who were killed and their bodies dumped in Laurel Canyon. Or they were either killed there or they were killed elsewhere and their bodies dumped. Marina Habe was one of them. I think Christina Weckler. And a third one that was never even identified. She was just Jane Doe number something.
Yeah.
All killed and either dumped or posed in the canyon, you know, during its heyday there in the 60s and 70s. I mean, it was just amazing how many bodies, how much blood was flowing out of this canyon, and, you know, in directly contradicting, you know, the whole peace, love, and understanding vibe that we're, you know,
right,
that we're supposed to.
Let me correct the George Reeves thing. That was Benedict Canyon. I just checked.
Benedict Canyon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But how many of these murders were actually solved?
Not all of them were listed as murders. Ramon Navarro's was listed as a murder, and it was blamed on two brothers. You know, whether or not they were the actual culprits, who knows? Sal Mineo's was acknowledged as a murder, and I think that one, they claimed that it was solved. The Manson murders, you know, the Wonderland murders, various others. There was another guy right after the Wonderland murders, another drug dealer, a guy who was also a music industry guy. He was a songwriter. He'd written songs that had been recorded by, you know, people, you know, very prominent artists, I think like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and he'd done some of his own work. I can't remember his name, but he was found in his garage with his head splattered with a shotgun, and that one was ruled a suicide, but you know, everybody that knew him at the time questioned that. So, you know, the ones that are listed as murders were mostly solved, but not all of them. But the biggest problem is that a lot of what looked like murders weren't treated as murders. So,
well, same old, same old.
Yeah.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, I mean, some of them just, you know, some of them just did not look accidental at all. And, you know, I mean, they're just very, very curious circumstances.
Yeah. Did you, Dave, come across people who worked there or lived there who talked to you about the strange goings on there? And I haven't been able to read the book yet, but, I mean, people who knew, we'd call them whistleblowers today, but people who let the cat out of the bag. The military aspect, of course, is fascinating, and I'm wondering if some of the recordings were made in their facilities even, the studio recordings, or was it just film?
You know, it's quite possible that the audio recording, you know, could have gone on there. You know, you were talking before we went on break about the possibility of, you know, some subliminal things going on with the music, which I think is indeed quite possible. You know, if you look at like the Grateful Dead, you know, their longtime sound engineer was Augustus Owsley Stanley III, I think it was what his full name was. He was also very well known for being the acid guru who picked up a lot of the LSD that circulated in both San Francisco and L.A., and his training was in radio intelligence work. You know, he was an electronics prodigy who had been trained in radio intelligence.
What a coincidence. How strange.
And then he, you know, and then he went to work shaping the Grateful Dead sound. And same thing with Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa, before he became famous, spent a lot of time with his guy in a little independent studio in the L.A. area. I think it was called Powell Studios or something. And I can't remember the guy's name, but it was the same thing. He was a veteran radio intelligence guy who had been, you know, trained in radio intelligence work, and then he came here to L.A. and opened up a sound studio, and he's the guy that first taught Frank Zappa everything that he knew about overdubbing and multi-tracking and, you know, all of the studio wizardry that he then used to great effect throughout his career. So, you know, you have some guys, you know, at least a couple of guys behind the scenes shaping this sound who were specifically trained in radio intelligence work. So not a big leap to suspect that, you know, that kind of thing may have been going on.
Not at all. Frank Zappa was one of the most intelligent people to come out of the pop music world. Toward the end, he was saying some very interesting things, kind of like George Carlin. He matured and flowered, and at the end was just really right on with his condemnations of what was happening in this country. He knew.
He's definitely an intelligent, well-educated guy, and certainly very talented. You know, nobody would dispute that, you know, his sound wasn't necessarily all that accessible,
right,
which is why he never achieved anywhere near the mainstream success of, you know, these other artists that were on the scene. But he was definitely regarded as one of the most talented guys on the scene by far, as a composer, musician, arranger, producer. He spent a lot of time locked away in his studio working on his sound. I mean, he was known as an absolute perfectionist and for being very tyrannical and autocratic and very, very difficult to work with, because he knew exactly what he wanted, and he insisted on getting exactly what he wanted. And consequently, he had a very high turnover rate because he was not an easy guy to work with. And he's not the only one. You know, Arthur Lee of Love was much the same, also regarded as a phenomenally talented guy, but just impossible to work with because he just, you know, he had very specific ideas.
What about
what he wanted his sound to be, and you know?
Well, how about the Doors and Morrison's death and all that?
What's that?
The Doors.
The Doors. Well, the Doors are an interesting band, to say the least. You know, Jim Morrison was probably the most unlikely rock star that we've ever had.
Really? Why? Now, for those who don't know, why would you say that?
Well, because he himself said in interviews that before joining the band and, you know, coming out here, he never had any interest in music. He never, you know, he was not a student of music at all. He didn't know how to read music. He didn't know how to write music. He never learned to play an instrument. He told interviewers that he'd never had any interest in singing before and really wasn't even all that interested in listening to music. He claimed that he'd only been to like a couple of live concerts before, you know, he himself became a rock star. And if you look at pictures of him, which is one in the book from 1964, just a year or so before he emerged on the scene, you see this very conservative, clean-cut, collegiate-looking young man that looks absolutely nothing like the Jim Morrison that we all know and love.
Uh-huh.
So you have this guy who, in the space of like a year, just sort of transformed, you know, not just physically, but he just emerged like as this fully formed rock icon with a look and a sound and a stage presence and just seemingly out of nowhere. And in this whole catalog of songs, and, you know, it just all just seemed to come out of nowhere from this guy who had no previous interest in being a rock star or having anything to do with music in general. And then after a few years of that, he seemed to lose interest once again and wanted to just kind of go off and be this reclusive, you know, drug-addled poet. And so he's a fascinating guy. In the space of like 3 years, from like 1964 to 71, I think is when he died, or allegedly died anyway. That's a whole other topic. But in the space of like 7 years, this guy occupied three distinctly different personas.
Uh-huh.
To the point where if you look at pictures, you know, I mean, it's kind of hard to believe that it's even the same guy in the same period of his life.
Oh, interesting.
You know? So he had a remarkable capacity for reinventing himself, which is one of the reasons why I don't doubt at all that he may very well have faked his death over in Paris and reinvented himself once again and gone on to be who knows what.
Interesting.
So,
possible.
He was a fascinating character. And then there's the fact that, you know, as I said at the beginning, his father was in fact the Navy Admiral who oversaw the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So you have this very strange timing where almost simultaneously the father is over like kickstarting the Vietnam War while the son is emerging on the scene as this big icon of the anti-war crowd. So, so you have that whole strange dynamic. So the Doors are very, very, very interesting band on a lot of levels.
I still wonder, a lot of these things are predicated on melodies. And if computers or research were used to generate melody ideas or thematic material that was kind of discovered or given to some of these bands, they were hypnotic.
You know, I mean, it's very strange that they all kind of, not only that they all ended up huddled in the same space, but they all kind of adopted the same sort of sound.
That's what I'm saying.
Mamas and the Papas,
were they all copying each other? I don't think so. I think something else going on.
Well, it doesn't seem like it, because, like, the Mamas and the Papas, they wrote their first album supposedly while they were down in the Caribbean, on St. Thomas Island, and they were, you know, sort of isolated and removed from the rest of the musical community, and then I have quotes from them saying that, you know, here they come into L.A. from being off on this, whatever it was they were doing. And they just happened to have this whole album full of songs that just happened to, have come from the same template as what the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield and these other bands were coming up with. And yet they supposedly wrote theirs, you know, far removed from the whole scene. And you know, there was no such thing as folk rock. And yet it just sort of simultaneously came out of these different people from that were removed from each other geographically and otherwise. So it doesn't really seem like they were copying each other. It seems like there was something else at play, you know?
I agree. All right. The music then and the so-called music now, just a kind of an off-topic question. This whole rap culture, the cadence, the hypnotic stuff. Any guesses? Now, we have a number of examples of people who have said they have sold their soul to Satan for fame and riches. Lots of them. And then you've got this incredible flip-flop of Miley Cyrus, who has gone so far over the top the other way, it's really almost too hard to believe. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, now that's, there's definitely a pattern that's developed in regards to Miley Cyrus. And, I mean, she's basically following the template that was provided by, Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera to some extent. And all three of them came from the Disney stable, actually, didn't they?
I think they did.
Didn't Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera start out as, like, Mouseketeers? And Miley Cyrus, of course, made her name as Hannah Montana, which I think was on the Disney Channel. So they were all, like, they all started out as with this very, very wholesome, you know, very family-oriented, you know, family-friendly Disney image. And then it seems like, you know, I mean, they barely turn 18 and all of a sudden they've transformed into this wild, you know, like sex kitten thing.
Yeah, and all of their disciples and sycophants and fans follow them right along.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be a definite trend underway of sexualizing children, you know, and it's very disturbing, to say the least. And, you know, I mean, I consider myself very liberal-minded, and I don't consider myself a prude or anything, but I am a father of three daughters, and I find it very disturbing how that there seems to be an ongoing trend to sexualize children. And, you know, and, these performers, they gather legions of very young fans, you know, tween girls or whatever they call them, not quite teenagers,
right.
and then they lead them astray, you know, after a couple of years. And,
well, they do. They take control of them. They actually become ingrained into the consciousness of these young tweens, and then they walk with them right through puberty, through legal adulthood, 18. And they've flipped, and when they flip, I'll bet 90% of them follow them along.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, you know, there's a much, much, much larger disconnect these days between talent and fame.
Oh, what talent?
You know,
it's all a manufactured product, all of it.
Yeah, it totally is, you know, and that's the question I get asked all the time about Laurel Canyon, because, well, you know, are you just slamming all these people? Are you saying that they're all just
no you're
talent?
Not. You're not doing that at all.
And I'm not. That was kind of the golden age compared to what we have now, because, you know, these techniques have been refined, it seems like, to such a point that talent kind of, you know, irrelevant.
You just said it all.
They can give you a marketable face and
you
image.
Just said it
they
all.
Can make you a huge international star nowadays, you know?
You said the whole thing. Talent is irrelevant. Correct.
It's amazing now that these people just can come out of nowhere, your Lady Gagas or your Rihannas or Beyoncés or Miley Cyruses or, you know, whoever it is, whoever the flavor of the month is, they just emerge on the scene as these these huge international stars that just have millions of Twitter followers and tens of millions of YouTube hits. And, I mean, they just fame and critical acclaim that's like so wildly out of proportion to the actual talent, you know? So, say what you will about the 60s people, they may have been fully controlled, but they were actually talented.
Cream, Three Men, incredible output. And only together for 2 years. Just a remarkable heritage from that band.
Yeah, I mean, some of these people were just phenomenally talented, you know, and some of the most talented ones are you know, aren't even remembered all that well, like Arthur Lee in Love, you know, regarded at the time as possibly the best band on the strip, but way overshadowed in most people's minds by, you know, the Doors and the Birds and the Mamas and the Papas and all the ones that we still hear on the radio today.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there were some phenomenally talented people that came out of that band.
Indeed. Well, Dave, it's been really a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on the research. It's something that needed to be done, and you did it. And people just overlooked it. It's quite a nugget of real history. Weird Secrets Inside the Canyon by David McGowan. You click on Dave's name or the name of the book under at guests@rents.com and get the book. It's quite a trip, as they say. Thank you, David. We'll talk again.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Be well. All right. That's our program tonight, and we'll be back with you tomorrow night. Have a good evening. Take care.